Hi, this is Scott Snibbe, host of A Skeptic's Path to Enlightenment. My new book, How to Train a Happy Mind, shares the accessible approach to Buddhism familiar to podcast listeners. It features a foreword by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and you can order it right now in print, ebook, or audiobook, just about anywhere you buy books. In May, I'm doing two special events in New York City, one with musician and artist Laurie Anderson, and another with DJ Spooky. Both events can also be streamed online. Go to our website at skepticspath.org for more details on the book and tour. I'm Scott Snibbe, and this is A Skeptic's Path to Enlightenment. This is an exciting episode for the podcast because my book, How to Train a Happy Mind, comes out today. To celebrate its release, we're sharing a conversation I had with best-selling author Vicky McKenzie a couple of weeks ago at a book preview event in London in front of a live audience. This podcast is where I develop most of the ideas for the book based on more than a decade leading meditations that eventually formed many of our episodes. I want to thank all our listeners for your feedback and support over these 4 years. You've helped me develop the book's simple 8-step program that combines Tibetan Buddhism with modern science and psychology, and I'm excited to hear what you think about it. If you'd like to buy How to Train a Happy Mind, you can find it anywhere you buy books. I've donated all my proceeds from the book to the Skeptic's Path to Enlightenment nonprofit, so your purchase helps support this podcast.
So hello everyone here in the temple and online, and hello Somaya, really nice to see you.
Oh, nice.
So my name is Drolma. I'm the center director here at Jamyang, and on behalf of Watkins Publishing and Jamyang, we want to welcome you for this event tonight. It's the pre-release event of Scott Snibbe's book that we've been really, really looking forward to, How to Train a Happy Mind. And we're really delighted that Vicky McKenzie is going to be interviewing Scott tonight. Vicky McKenzie is an award-winning journalist and best-selling author. And so, Vicky, thank you for coming tonight. So I'll pass over.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, I think we're on. So first of all, I'd rather think of this not so much as an interview. I'm hoping we're going to have a conversation. Before I get on to that, I think I'm going to ask a bit about Scott before we get into the meat of the matter. Scott, tell me a bit about your background. You're obviously American, so you don't speak very clearly. But not only that, you know, you're American. What is your background, religious-wise and educational-wise?
I'm ethnically Jewish, and my parents converted to be Christian Scientists when I was born because my mother had an awful experience in the hospital. Christian Scientists don't go to the doctor. They believe they can heal themselves through prayer, which I personally don't believe. But there was a beautiful aspect of Christian Science, which is that it believes that everything is mind and that the material world is like a shadow or a reflection of the mental, which is very close to what's called the mind-only school Tibetan Buddhism. So I was raised with a mind-only school, which is very close to the what's called the Madhyamaka, the kind of what in this tradition is seen as the highest school of understanding the nature of reality. But I left that church. I kind of saw like what the Buddhists saw, that there's sickness, aging, and death. Nobody escapes death. Everything that's invisible always fascinated me more than the visible.
Wow.
So I don't know. I could go on.
That's the mystic side of things. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the mystic side. But I found Buddhism when I was about 30, you know, when my brother became a Buddhist when I was 26 or so. And I was nervous that by becoming a Buddhist, he would lose his personality. He was kind of a skate punk photojournalist skateboarder. But after 4 years observing him, I saw that it didn't. He still had personality, but he was kinder and gentler and so on. And so I invited him to see the Dalai Lama as a kind of gift. I wasn't interested in becoming Buddhist, but I know how much my brother liked it. And I thought we'd have fun. But the instant I saw the Dalai Lama in the year 2000, I was 30. I said, I want what he's having.
Yeah.
You know, I really was very skeptical about reincarnation, karma, other realms of existence. But I saw the result of someone who had lived through a genocide of his people and yet was so loving and kind and compassionate. You know, something he said really struck me. He said, if we kill one Chinese person, then we make 100 enemies. It just doesn't make sense, you know? So anyway, that was why I became a Buddhist in like 25 years ago. And
you know, it's the best introduction. Huh. I'm a journalist, so I'm not an easy believer.
Yeah.
You know, you're taught to question, and I loved it that Lama Yeshe kept saying, check up, check up. It was what I was really longing for, to have that kind of intelligence,
yeah.
You know, to say, don't just accept everything I'm saying. You check up, which was just what I was doing in my job. You know, that's what you do. Now, what I want to ask you, apart from your religious background, do you have a scientific background? Because when I read your book, you're very keen on linking it always with science. So I wondered if you have a scientific bent.
I am not a scientist. My wife is a scientist, and she will double confirm that. But the thing is, I always was so in awe of what science taught us about reality. Like as a kid, I watched this show called Cosmos, you know, with Carl Sagan. And
yeah.
I think that was the beginning of seeing how vast the universe is and how short the human span of existence is. But I'm always fascinated by that. And I even started a company that I ran for a long time that did exhibits in science museums. But I'm not a particularly scientific individual. I am skeptical, but it's very intense. And I really admire the discipline of real scientists because they have to narrow so sharply their focus to perform a controlled experiment. I like to just enjoy the wash of all the results and allow that to give me that sense of awe that I think people who are religious feel at the sense of God. And I think I feel that. And I think probably many people today feel that at the 100 billion galaxies of the trillions of living beings and entities in our bodies and so on.
Yeah, it's vast. Now, I'm interested that you're not that scientific because in your book, you talk a fair bit about, like, the scientific proof. People want scientific proof. I was one of the questions I was going to ask you later on, but it's come up now, is that actually science can't prove anything because they just work with theory. You're probably, I don't know anything about science. So I'm treading on very difficult water here. But science just does theory, comes up with theory. Then they gather a lot of evidence. And then they go around trying to prove and measure what they have. But then sooner or later, somebody will come along and they'll have improved the instruments that they're measuring with, and then they'll all change their minds. So I don't really hold science in that respect in very high regard.
Well,
as a proof thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think maybe we can go on to that. Oh,
but go into that because the best scientists would agree with you. So one of my very favorite scientists is a British scientist named David Deutsch, and he works in quantum computing, quantum theory. And he wrote an extraordinary book called The Beginning of Infinity. And in that book, he explains how all that science does, it moves from more wrong to less wrong models of reality.
Yeah.
True scientists are extremely humble like that. And they all admit that everything they do is a model of reality. But it does come closer and closer. It never touches absolute truth. His view is that knowledge is infinite, that we will never, ever discover the ultimate theories of reality. There'll always be more to discover, more to learn. Yeah. And that relates, you know, some to the Buddhist view too.
Yeah, it's fascinating because there are many different types of scientists.
Yes.
So let's get on to your book. How would you define happy? That it seems to be the goal.
It's hard to find the right words in English for these. Part of why Buddhism has been so hard to translate in the West is because we don't even have the words for these states of mind. Contentment might be a bit, but in English, contentment seems quite boring.
Yeah.
But like contentment is very extraordinarily good feeling in Buddhism. And that's maybe the better word, is just to be absolutely satisfied with your life and with the world, accepting everything as it is, and then have an enormous amount of energy to keep transforming yourself for the better and to try to transform the world for the better.
Yeah.
A lot of people think it's internal, that the ultimate goal of Buddhism is to be still and peaceful in a cave at the top of a pinnacle and ignore everything, but it's very engaged. It surprised me very much once, because I asked Venerable Sangye Kadro, who's, you know, one of our teachers, you know, how do you measure if your meditation is going well? Because you can have very nice feelings in a meditation session, like you can have amazing visions and feel very calm and concentrated, then come out and come get in an argument with your partner, you know, which this is something I've done.
Yeah,
so she said, the measure of your success in meditation is that your relationships get better. And that's a quote from Lama Yeshe. And so that's also something I would mention, is that a lot of people think of meditation as something kind of internal, personal, like a kind of inner achievement. But really, it's something that should affect your relationships and also how you relate to the world, and ideally make it a little bit better.
Yes. But isn't it also something to do with suffering? Because we mustn't forget that the Buddha's whole quest, when he sat under that tree, was how do we relieve suffering? And I would argue with you that maybe suffering brings us closer to enlightenment, because it's not just about having good relationships.
Well, that's the paradox, right? Like, don't you think, like, what I've found in Buddhism is almost all the profound aspects of Buddhism are paradoxes. Because I said satisfaction, but again, maybe a better translation for suffering is dissatisfaction, you know, unsatisfactory. And that's normally how you start off in teaching Buddhism, but it doesn't work that well for Westerners to start with the topic of suffering for some reason or another. But that is really the core of it, that the external aspects of even nice relationships are unsatisfactory. Even the very best relationship you can possibly have is impermanent.
You well, everything is
impermanent.
It doesn't
last, yeah.
Yes. And I mean, so, which you go into very well in this book.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I do think that we do learn more from the hard times in life than sitting on a yacht drinking a martini. You know, which some people think is, you know, achievement. Interestingly enough, I found this quote from the Dalai Lama, which surprised me, in his book, The Art of Happiness, if I can find it. Mm. In Buddhism, there are four factors of fulfillment or happiness: wealth, worldly satisfaction, spirituality, and enlightenment. Together, they embrace the totality of an individual's quest for happiness. And I thought that was very fair, because I think you can't really just take away the fact that wealth, well, as my father used to say, you know, You can be with wealth, you can be miserable in comfort, but it can do a lot of good, wealth and worldly satisfaction. But it's interesting, maybe they are increments towards spirituality and enlightenment, but they also count. Maybe we shouldn't discount them.
And that's a difference between, you know, our tradition and Mahayana Buddhism, sometimes compared to like the Theravada Buddhism, where some strains of Buddhism are absolutely renouncing material comforts, and you try to stay away from, you know, a nice bed and so on. The Tibetan Buddhism, right, the Mahayana Buddhism is different. It actually says you can enjoy those things, but you'll actually enjoy them more if you realize they're unsatisfactory, right?
Well, they don't last.
Yeah, you'll actually have better enjoy your meal, better enjoy your relationship if you realize it's impermanent, that it's not going to last, that it in itself isn't satisfactory, right? Because then you're completely present and you're not like a junkie who needs more and more and more and more. You realize this could end. I'll enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah. Okay. So going back to the Lam Rim, which you've written about, certainly when I went to my first Lam Rim course, I took away, I think it was 3 or 4 things that I thought were very useful that I could meditate on. When you first encountered Lam Rim, what were the things that struck you that were useful in your life?
Impermanence is really I think the topic that really struck me first, and it's also the topic that I would usually introduce to someone who's never tried meditation at all. I'll put this in a story actually, because it was at right after the September 11th attacks.
Yeah.
I happened to be in Boston visiting my brother, and he has a Tibetan teacher too, Geshe Sulga. And so that teacher gave a teaching the day after those attacks because everyone was very distraught.
Yeah.
And I was very surprised on the topic he chose, because he didn't choose the topic of mindfulness, which is really like the most popular Western topic of Buddhism. And he didn't choose compassion either, although he did express compassion. His main teaching was in impermanence. And he said, you know, listen, nobody thought that building was going to fall yesterday. If you're honest with yourself, you thought it would stand forever. That is the thing to take away from this moment, is to really get it into your mind and as a realization that everything is impermanent. Right now, we look at this building. This building could come down tomorrow, just like those twin towers. It could last 500 years. And it was conceived and built by people hundreds of years ago. Mm-hmm. To see that in a regular, especially with human beings, to look at everyone in this room, think, wow, think of that moment when it came out of their mother, you know, and how precious that moment was and difficult that was to the mother. And to think of the moment that each of you is going to die also. To see things like that all the time.
But did you think that you were going to die? Have you thought about, did it teach you that you were going to die?
Absolutely. But I was someone always very fascinated, like not in a morbid way, with death. Well, I'll tell you again, something very personal. As a child and up until the age of like 7 or 8, the moment I woke up every morning, I have a very profound feeling that I lived forever and I'm going to live forever. You know, and I can't explain that feeling. In Buddhism, we might explain that as, you know, your karma or something. Yeah.
Did you mean by live forever?
I don't know what I meant. I just felt it. I just felt it kind of down to my core. So I was never really afraid of death. I was kind of born unafraid of death, so I was kind of cheating. So I like to just admit that, it wasn't something
So you had that. It changed my life, the death meditation.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about
it. No, it was, I'm just saying how it affects you personally.
Yeah.
Because I think that's really important, because hopefully everybody will get a personal feeling from the meditations.
Yeah.
So when I was given the death meditation to do in 1976, I was never afraid of death either. But what it did is it rearranged my whole priorities of how I wanted to live. I changed then. I went freelance so I could write the stories I wanted to write. And I began to write about things which were, you know, I'd been taught about in the Lam Rim, which was that, unlike your experience, I got the fact that, you know, when they told me that birth was part of the unsatisfactory and the baby went through and it was difficult. And I thought, wow, that's an interesting idea, because everyone has such a romantic idea about birth. You know, it's all this romantic thing and life coming in and the graphic. And it was the time when all the new births without violence and water births.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'm going to go and interview those people and those mothers and see if the children had any different than they had. So I did that. That was the first story I did. And I did that from the Copan death meditation and the birth meditations. And actually the Sunday Times took it and gave me half a page. So, I mean, it radically changed my view on how, that's what I'm really asking you, whether or not death had any.
So we study, I do it in a much more gentle way in this book, because I led the death meditation once for people in the, you know, a lot of reasons why I wrote this book is because I was asked to teach the Lam Rim over and over again in Buddhist centers.
You don't actually include the death meditation. Well, I'm surprised.
I do it in a different way, because I felt like it was just too scary for people. When you're ready, you know, come and do this meditation. But you literally, like when I first learned it, we did it for 6 weeks, and you really get it into your skull. And it's very gruesome. You imagine every possible way you could die.
I know.
And
I think
it is
Lama
very
Zopa.
Powerful. Yeah. But people just aren't ready for like this horror. It's like a horror movie starring you. That you meditate on.
Well, no, I don't agree with you there. I think you should frighten people.
No, it's I agree. We should. it's just, it's better to, that's a good first step. I don't think that most people are ready. What I saw in the Buddhist Center, Vicky, is that people would come in. We'd advertise, welcome to everyone. You don't have to be a Buddhist. Learn the Lam Rim, the stages of the path to enlightenment. The very first topic talks about karma, rebirth, other realms, like having been a ghost, a turtle, a god.
Yeah.
It was not meeting people where they were, or even the promise of what we were saying. So I tried it once, the death meditation, and I felt like there were people who came in and that was the first and last time they ever meditated. So it was just not the right time. It wasn't the right. I think if someone has never tried Lam Rim, it may be better to start with impermanence, you know, thinking about that people were born and everyone's going to die and things are changing right now. And I might not have this meal again. So let's enjoy it. Like, that's a good way to start. Like, the horror movie starring you is maybe for a few years out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I got it. I'd never done any meditation at all. And there were some things which I didn't agree with, and the karma thing I didn't agree with. But I have to say that doing that death meditation helped me enormously when my father died and when my mother died. Yeah. I knew exactly. I mean, if I hadn't been prepared for death can happen any moment, you know, and all the rest of it, it would have been very, very hard, especially for my mother, who dropped down dead standing next to me, walking into the kitchen. So, I mean, they are tough. And I think the Lam Rim is tough.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
I think it's very tough. Yeah. I grappled a lot as well. And karma I grappled with. I couldn't take karma for decades. I thought it was a ridiculous idea. You know, that things that you've done in your past life would be that this baby would die when it was 6 months old. I thought it was just ridiculous. And so I just put all that on the back burner. But I have to say that as I've gone on and on, it has made more sense to me. You know, these.
And the thing is, like, there's a lot of asymmetries in Buddhism, right? Because as an individual, it's very powerful to start to feel like, okay, I'm not in total control here. There's things happening to me I can't explain.
Yeah.
And I need to just accept them
one way
or another. But the place it goes wrong is when we start to project it on others and say, oh, well, that person is poor due to their karma. Like, that's just their lot in this current life. That's not how Buddhism necessarily teaches it, but that can be a misunderstanding.
It is definitely a misunderstanding. Yeah. It doesn't mean that you're not sympathetic and kind, loving and towards the person who is suffering. But sometimes it can explain why totally inexplicable tragedies happen, not just to you.
Yeah.
I mean, it might not be correct, but it is an explanation. I mean, what I think the Lam Rim does is they kind of cover every possible situation. They've got an answer for everything.
Oh, yeah.
Every single thing, they've got an answer
for. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, something that really always confused me is why I would have a very strong reaction to strangers. You know, just walking down the street.
Yeah.
Like, you see someone and you think, I really want to get to know them, or I would love to be their partner or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you see other people like, who is that jerk?
Yeah.
I just don't like them.
No,
for some
you can
reason.
Walk into a room and suddenly you don't want to meet. Yeah.
Yeah. And then other people are like, who cares? That to me is actually one of the strongest things that make me kind of believe in karma is just the strength of reactions.
Sure.
I'll have, and like when I met my wife, you know, like she's the one. you know, why? Why does that happen, right?
It also happens with places.
Yeah.
Does it happen to you? I go to certain countries and I feel completely at home and I feel relaxed. And some countries, for absolutely no reason at all, they're perfectly nice places. I'm on edge. I don't like them. I've got to get out, you know? So I think there is these inexplicable things which can't be explained, and they certainly couldn't be explained scientifically.
Oh, yeah.
But I think also in the Lam Rim, where it's so helpful, is just as you've said, they're brilliant. You know, we said in Christianity, love thy neighbor as thyself. But they didn't tell you how, especially when your neighbor was a pain. Whereas in Lam Rim, they actually give you, this is what you do. You know, this is what you do. How you get to love everybody in the world unconditionally. And that's an amazing. For me, it was an amazing thing, and I've worked with that because I do have a very difficult neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like how, you know, you can change your relationships, how there's no such thing as the total loved one or the total enemy or the total person you couldn't care less about. But it's brilliant, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And that's the other one, like impermanence. The other one is equanimity, which is like the ground. This is rarely taught. And so I spend a bit of time on it in the book. That meditation was very profound for me because I get very attached. My main delusion is more like attachment, you know, and although I get angry also. But that meditation on equanimity is extraordinary because you go through this meditation where you think about a friend and then you think when that friend was, when you first met them and they were just a stranger.
Yeah.
And you also think about friends who became enemies.
Yeah.
You know, especially with relationships, you know, that's, I think, has happened to all of us. And you go all the way through that enemies that became some, have any of you had enemies that become friends? That's happened to me. That's rare. But it does happen.
It does happen.
It does happen.
Especially if they do something nice for you.
Yeah, the moment they can say one nice, you've hated them forever. They say one nice thing. You're like,
okay, then you like them. You're in my camp now.
But the thing is, it's systematic, right? Like in the lab room, there's a 4-step version. There's a 7-step version. There's an 11-step version to feeling absolute love and compassion for all beings. And if you start to do it every day, that's the impact. It changes your relationships and you realize, then when your partner's annoying, you're like, it's natural for me to feel that way. Yeah. And it's absolutely guaranteed to change.
Yeah.
And if I let it be without having such a strong reaction to it, it will naturally evolve to its next stage.
And it can change within the same friendship, relationship, work situation. You can go up on these different types of level, even in a day.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you can change these. I mean, we're not balanced, really. Yeah. Tenzin Palmo, who I wrote about, She got on the Buddhist path because she was working in a library in the East End in Bethnal Green. And this book kind of fell out the shelf at her called The Mind Unshaken. And she suddenly grabbed it. It was a book about Buddhism. And it was how not to have this shaken mind, which goes up and down. I mean, we're ridiculous, really, aren't we? The sun comes out and we're happy. The clouds come over, down. Then so we go up and down, just even with the weather. You know, we can't even keep a kind of level mind at all. Anyway, but I know there are going to be questions, but I just want to ask you one, because we haven't covered, which I think is the most interesting part, is the skeptic part. Now, I was skeptical totally about all sorts of things, but karma was one. The guru thing was another. And of course, and hell realm. So I just thought that was ridiculous too. Yeah. So was there anything that particularly you were, well, you've told me, I think.
I mean, all of them, absolutely. The one about the guru is very good because, you know, in our tradition, you're even supposed to see your guru as a Buddha.
Above the Buddha.
As
even, tricky, isn't it?
I think that was very confusing, certainly at first, was even bowing down. You know, like in our culture, we're taught that everyone's equal, but a lot of the equality is that everyone equally deserves our criticism, you know? Yeah. So I think that was one of the things that affected me most was the respect, honestly, like the respect and the devotion that you have towards someone who's really realized these teachings. Yeah. You have to, sometimes you see it instantly, like you do with His Holiness. Sometimes it's over years of observing someone and like with Geshe Dakpa, you know, my Tibetan teacher, one of my main teachers. Some of the lessons I learned from him was not the deep intellectual things that he shared, but I remember someone questioning him over and over again. He was teaching and the person said like, no, I don't think that's really true. You know, and then Geshe Dakpa explained again the point. They're like, no, I don't think that's right. And then Geshe Dakpa, like the third time he said, maybe you're right.
Yeah.
Like that was one of the most profound teachings.
Yeah.
Was the humility of one of the most learned, accomplished, realized beings on earth to be so humble in the face of this very rude question asked three times.
Yeah.
Like those are the moments that really transform. Because I thought I need to be like, that's how I need to be.
Yeah.
When I, you know, someone who I see as being rude to me or something, if I need to be very humble, I can try.
That was one of the qualities which I really observed when I first saw Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa. Not a kind of cringing humility, but they weren't full of pomp or...
Yeah.
I mean, I think their laughter and Lama Yeshe coming and thanking everybody. You just walk into the Gompa and just start thanking everybody. And I was thinking, well, here's this extraordinary being who's thanking me. Well, why? Well, I haven't done anything, you know, but there is that the lovely quality. I suppose it's about really losing, I think, which is the real purpose of the Lam Rim, to get rid of that false sense of the ego.
Yeah.
I mean, not that egolessness means they're blobs, because they're very vital, you know. I mean, not me, but I mean, when you see these great beings, they do have, I mean, maybe it's not personality, but they're vivid and they're very different and they are, you know, they are individuals.
Yeah. And well, this is one of the things that kept me from Buddhism for so long, was thinking that you lose your personality. But His Holiness said it. I heard him say once, you know, everyone gets enlightened in their own way. Like, that was so, because I think a lot of us think we just blend into a universal consciousness or something. It doesn't sound fun at all. It sounds like awful. You're just a blur. Yeah. But, and the Dalai Lama proves that though. Like, he said it, but he also proves it. Because look at him. He has a huge personality. He's very teasing and funny. And he has a huge personality and no ego.
Yeah. It's and he's completely himself, isn't he?
Yeah.
There are no heirs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he does, if you ask like Thubten Jinpa, you know, his longtime translator, he does get angry. He does get sad, but it just flows through. You know, it's like Jinpa explained, like the Dalai Lama will just be, someone will come and tell him a sad story and he'll just be bawling. Then the next person will come and instantly he's joyful and happy.
Yeah.
Like that's the way you can be, is that.
Yeah.
That's what really struck me about Buddhism over time.
Yeah.
Is that you don't stop feeling things. It's just that they pass through you and
they definitely got feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they don't have to like irritate you.
Yeah.
Through craving or through, you know, anger. It's just they pass through you.
Yeah. No, it's very, very lovely to see. Okay, so one thing that I wanted to think there might be a danger, I wanted to discuss with you, is do you think there's a danger in this more secular type of Buddhism which is coming up, that it's another method of self-improvement? Not that that's contradictory, because of course Buddhism is all about self-improvement, but another kind of how to become a better, shinier me, you know, which is... I don't know. It's something about, it goes against this kind of humility we're talking about, which is so attractive in the really, really high practitioners, you know, like it's another accomplishment, another danger of self-absorption, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I've seen that in myself, you know, as a practice and, you know, also it seems to appear in some people that I know too. It's hard because we treat, in the West, we treat everything like an accomplishment. I think that's why it's really important, these measure of meditations. Cause I had a person come and talk to me, explained a really cool experience they had in meditation. And they said, the only way I can explain it is enlightenment. You know, and I was like, okay, we, in our tradition, we have a few like ways to measure that. You know, that's why I like this very firm advice that the measure of success in your meditation is that your relationships improve, that your behavior becomes, you know, tamed and gentler and kinder. I hope that's one of the messages of the book, is like, that's not, I think this isn't just a cool experience.
No, I think you can expand that too, Scott. Like for me, it's like not being so impatient.
Yeah.
Like in the supermarket queue or in the traffic jam.
Yeah. I think generally you can have very cool experiences in meditation. And you have that kind of early on in your path. Whenever I went to my teachers, like Venerable Rene, other teachers, and I said, oh, I had this cool experience. Like I saw this, I felt this, you know, I concentrate for this long. And then they would just say, that's very nice. You know, how's your relationship with your partner? How do you feel when you don't get what you want?
Yeah.
You know, that's the measure of your success in meditation. It's how you've tamed your mind. It's not just a cool thing that happens to you.
I think people are looking for, especially today, when lots of people are going for meditation, and fair enough, you know, to be relaxed and less anxious, which is very good. I mean, if that can provide that, excellent. But really, I think we have to be careful of the fireworks, although they're very And they're very nice and they're very encouraging.
Yeah. And that's why it's nice to explain, you know, analytical meditation to people. And the definition, you know, a definition of meditation is bringing out your best qualities.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as calm and peace is part of it.
Yeah.
But bringing out your best qualities and then learning what are your best qualities.
Yeah.
Like we were talking about this before, like the absolute foundation of Buddhist ethics, the very first principle is nonviolence.
Yeah.
The next one is kindness.
Yeah.
The third one is understanding your mind. Very few people would list those three things as like the foundation of ethics, but that's the ground of Buddhism. So.
Yes. Yes. That's right. Which is very beautiful, that groundwork. Ethics.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, with this book, it's a little different than other, because there are other books like Stephen Batchelor's books and so on. This is a little different because I'm actually not saying karma doesn't exist. Like I actually personally do believe in these things, but it took me quite some time in my own way. But what I'm saying is if you don't believe in those things, here's a way to practice.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes, I know. You've been a bit sneaky writing that. I noticed you snuck it in.
Yeah.
There is this idea about Buddha. There is this idea. But you're right. And you're completely right because there are a lot of people, you know, it might put them off, but I say blow it, let them be put off, but at least give it to them.
Yeah, and that's Robert Thurman. There's room for all of these different approaches.
Yes, there are.
But mine is like very gentle. It's just, hey, I'll meet you where you are. It's for like my friends, you know, same thing. My friends who asked me for 25 years, what book should I start with?
Yes, exactly.
And I didn't have one to give them.
No,
I finally wrote it.
No, you're like, absolutely right.
Like the person, there are so many people that will never believe anything other than what science says about reality today. And that's very reasonable position to hold. Absolutely, very reasonable. And those people also want a spiritual path. And here's a way to get started with it.
You've bridged it very well. You bridged it very well. Yes, you did. Very, very tactful.
Try to be respectful to both, and gentle to both sides.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us for my book launch conversation with Vicky McKenzie about how to train a happy mind. The book is available to purchase anywhere you buy books. And if you end up enjoying it, please leave a positive review at Amazon or Goodreads to help other people discover it. I've also donated all my proceeds from the book to the Skeptic's Path nonprofit. If you'd like to deepen this conversation, please join our private meditation community and newsletter through the links on our website or follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks to Annie Nguyen for production and story editing, Christian Parry for mastering, and Isabella Acebal for marketing. We wish you a wonderful day.